content and material discussed in these podcasts are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for your professional veterinarian's advice, diagnosis, or treatments. Always seek the assistance of your own veterinarian with any questions you may have regarding the medical condition of your pet.
Excuse me, are you in the know? This is a Knowin.co production.
Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Gardens director Thane Maynard doesn't know he's a big deal, or if he does, he's too humble to let it show. Thane is an old racquetball friend. We used to get together on the court on a regular basis, so when I asked him, would he consider doing a podcast for me, he didn't hesitate. Of course, he said. In fact, I'll take you to meet Fiona. It's March, and it's the first beautiful day in the upper 60s with sun that we've seen in ages. The zoo is full of small kids and parents running around with post-winter, pent-up pandemic energy. Even the animals feel it. Spring is in the air. Thane later discussed how the animals missed us during lockdown, some more than others, of course. As we make our way to the administration building of the zoo, my producer is still stressed about how we make a podcast with a hippo. Hippos don't talk. What she doesn't know is that I know Thane will make the Fiona magic happen. We make our introductions and hit the ground running. As I sit making pleasantries and getting warmed up, I realize the interview started 10 minutes ago and I've not asked a single question yet. It's something about Thane. He's so excited and animated. Every conversation is a teachable moment. He mentions he's been with the zoo since 1977 after he graduated from the University of Michigan, and he's been the director for the last 15 years. I don't even know how that's possible. I think to myself, this man is ageless. So enjoy the history of the zoo in this portion of the interview. Cincinnati is a zoo town. We're with Thane Maynard, the director of the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden. Thank you so much for spending time with us. I'm Dr. Gary Clemens with Talking Pets Podcast, and we're here being shown around the zoo by Thane Maynard. What an honor.
Well, it's a lot of fun. It's fun to see you again and catch up on animals.
Exactly. This is great.
When Andrew Erkenbrecker and his cohorts, who were straight out of Stuttgart and Frankfurt, founded the zoo, it was part of a trend across America where immigrants were trying to reclaim some of what they had in European cities. And so they wanted a beautiful garden filled with exotic wildlife where they could host cultural events. Because in the 1870s, it's hard to imagine Cincinnati. I mean, it was thriving. That was our heyday. But it was also ugly. People were heating with coal. People were living over the Rhine. I mean, there wasn't a blade of grass. Kids had nowhere to go.
Pigs running down the street.
Correct. Right down Vine Street. When this zoo was founded, Vine Street was a dirt road.
And the breweries.
Yeah. So this idea of, at that time, this was almost like, you know, King's Island to them. There was a streetcar up here, but it was, you know, a long way. But that's what it provided, is a respite. Come out to a beautiful, shady garden and cultural events. And we still do all those things. You know, we have music here sometimes. We have the opera come back. We have a variety of things. So we're still doing it. I've never been to Germany, but people have told me that this zoo feels like the zoos in Stuttgart and Frankfurt, where those guys came from. And frankly, they told me that, say, for instance, over the Rhine and Walnut Hills, where so many of those buildings have been preserved, that those also feel like those German cities.
Yeah, they reminded them of over the Rhine, that area. Yeah, my grandparents were from Germany.
Yeah. Well, if you think of in Walnut Hills, where St. Francis de Sales Church, right there on that corner, and you're looking down, yeah, I've seen pictures from some German cities that look just like that, you know, these Italianate buildings, 3 to 4 stories tall, with a great big church at the end of the street. Our zoo has a great Midwest can-do attitude. So many things that we do, whether it's our sustainability program, our solar panels you parked under, the old motto, if you can do it, let's overdo it, right? I mean, we just go nuts. We have more, like we have the Festival of Lights, we have more lights than any zoo on earth at our Festival of Lights. Well, we certainly do more with plants, more with our botanical garden than any botanical garden I'm familiar with. It was just crazy. Certainly acre for acre we do. We have the highest attendance of any botanical garden in America. And that's because of Fiona, not because of the garden. But what the heck? Not everybody has Fiona. Yeah, over the years, we've grown to be the biggest attraction in the city of Cincinnati. and the biggest attraction in Hamilton County. Kings Island still outdraws us, but they're only open 6 months a year. And they're not in the county, they're out in Warren County.
It's got to be tough because you're in the city.
It is, yeah.
And there's not a lot
it
of
is,
land.
And we're right next to the hospital, and so it's expensive to buy land. That's a challenge. But little by little, basically what we're doing is reclaiming the zoo. When the zoo was founded, it was in the Victorian era, and there weren't any cars. So the whole thing was for animals and people. Then the first half of the 20th century, almost a third of the zoo got paved over. If you remember our old parking lot, that's Fiona's swimming in a pool right where the minivans used to park. So we're pushing all the cars out to make room. So that's good. It is a step at a time. And that's also the reason we have two farms out in the country. That's to breed cheetahs, as well as for some surplus animals, as well as for growing food for our animals. Because you can only do so much right in the city. But we make it work. This is a zoo town. People love this old zoo. Mm-hmm. You know, not every town is a zoo town. Atlanta, less so. Boston, less so. San Francisco, less so. But
why is that?
Most people really love their hometown zoo. You know, it's often a function of a combination of funding and tradition. I mean, as an example, in Atlanta, Georgia Aquarium opened in Atlanta probably 15 years ago, and that's a really nice aquarium, right downtown, right in the tourist area of Atlanta. So that's been a big hit, but it had a lot of funding. The zoo itself has sort of limped along, but most people love their hometown zoo. You know, you can go to 24 cities in America, and people will tell you, we've got one of the best zoos in America, because they have a lot of pride. And there are surprises that, you know, historically you say, okay, well, San Diego's great and the Bronx Zoo's great. And those are really big budget operations. But there are great zoos in many places you'd never expect, like Omaha, Nebraska, great zoo. You know, I mean, it's the biggest attraction in the whole state of Nebraska. Tulsa, Oklahoma, good zoo. You know, Jacksonville, Florida, ones you've never heard of. If you're ever driving to Florida on I-95, Jacksonville Zoo is just right off the highway. It's worth seeing. Very pretty. So, yeah, you never know. People always ask, you know, how's the zoo, our zoo ranked? There's no official ranking. Most people that really know zoos would give us high marks for in-depth education program, research program, conservation program. We'd probably be best known among zoo professionals for being an overachieving zoo. To pull off a zoo like this, right in the city, 67 acres, non-tourist town, bad weather town, we just do it. You know, this is a long way from San Diego, but we do it anyway.
But you're also a botanical park, too.
We are. That helps a lot. It does. The botanical garden adds a real beauty to it, a real part of our core message, too, that, A, you know, it's about ecosystems, not just about, say, large mammals. Large mammals pay our bills, but the system that supports nature is the whole system. Also, our botanical garden provides a great way for people to directly get involved. You know, you can plant for pollinators and help monarch butterflies, help local species by just the things you do in your own yard. So that's a neat thing because we all care about Asian elephants. We're building a great big facility and we're involved in protection of elephants in Northeast India. But very few people get to actively get involved protecting Asian elephants. You know, it's half a world away and it'd be hard to have an impact. Mm-hmm. Whereas protecting things right here in the tri-state, you can play a role. So that's pretty neat.
Do you grow much food here for the animals? Any of the plants here, or is it mostly in the farms?
We do grow some food here. You know, we have a big collection of insects, for instance, and they like to eat lots of different exotic plants. So around the zoo grounds in the garden or in our greenhouses, sometimes they'll get certain plants. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of bamboo that we use partly to screen off areas. You know, when the zoo gets crowded, it can seem really packed, but because there's a lot of winding paths and thick foliage, it doesn't seem quite as crowded. So keepers will trim bamboo for all kinds of things. You'd be surprised. Elephants like bamboo. Of course, red pandas, that's what they eat. But a lot of animals will chew on bamboo. But we do have two farms out in the country. And
what's the main purpose of that farm?
The one up in the Mason area called Boyer Farm is specifically to grow food for the zoo. We'll grow everything from hay to lots of native plants. We've planted lots of trees. A lot of animals love to chew on branches from, say, mulberry trees.
What do you have out there?
Well, the principal connection is in support of the zoo's botanical garden. You know, the Cincinnati Zoo, when it was founded in 1873, was called the Cincinnati Zoological Garden. And it's been a garden all that time. We officially changed the name in 1985 when we became an accredited botanical garden, which means, you know, we do scientific research, plant conservation, education programs, in addition to having a public garden. So we grow many, many plants that then we use here. We have many, many programs around our horticulture program where people can participate out there or even buy native plants. It's not a place, you know, generally open to the public just on a Tuesday, but we have native plant sales, we have special programs. We have an area where we run our cheetahs up there. So if you look at the zoo's website, you'll periodically through the season see, oh gosh, there's something going up there next weekend, and you could join in and see what's going on. And it's a lot of fun. You know, it's a neat area. We've reclaimed some wetland, which was great. You talk about nature is resilient. This area during the Depression, about 50 acres in the corner of the farm, someone had come in and put in drainage tile and taken an area that was a wetland so that they could grow on it. When we got a hold of the farm, it was given to the zoo. We couldn't afford to buy a 600-acre farm in Mason. We looked at that area and realized from the lay of the land that we could probably reclaim it. And the state of Ohio has a program that if, you know, wetlands are endangered, so if you want to do that, they'll help you do it. I am not kidding. You think, oh my gosh, you reclaimed the wetland. That must have taken a huge amount of money and work and years. No. They brought a backhoe, tore out the drainage tiles, and they drove away. And over the period of a season with the rains and the changes, you know, it's not a lake, so sometimes it's moist and sometimes it's not as moist. But species of plants that hadn't been out on that farm since the 30s, coming back out of the ground, the seeds weighed underground. Species of birds that hadn't been seen in Warren County by people that count, like the Audubon Society, were coming back. Things like bobolinks, quite rare birds. Boom, they came back.
When I was a kid, we didn't get to go to the zoo much, but we went a few times.
Yeah.
I can just remember the lions behind bars, mm-hmm. just doing that stereotypic pacing back and forth, and to see the change, particularly since you've been how long have you been the director now?
I've been director 15 years, since 2006.
The changes in 15 years are astronomical.
Well, we've been fortunate. We're on a roll with a lot of support. We get more private support at our zoo for our annual operating budget, as well as specifically for capital, because most zoos get tax money for new exhibits, and we don't. So Cincinnati is a very philanthropic town, so we're fortunate that way, that's for sure.
That helps.
Yeah, it does. The field of public education is to reach people, inspire them with wildlife. And we have a lot of programs. Yeah, we have a full-time high school called the Zoo Academy. It's been here since 1976. It's through CPS for 50 students. Lots of overnights. We've had to do a lot of adjustment since the COVID virus. We still have our education programs, but they're much smaller. Only 9 kids per group, you know, with one leader, etc. We haven't done overnights since last March. But we'll get back to it. I think it's going to open up soon.
It's great. In April, Don and I are going to take our RV down. We're going to Manatee Springs State Park.
Nice. Yeah.
And get to swim with the manatees, hopefully.
Absolutely. I just got back. Every year I go down at the end of February and go on a canoe trip with my daughter, who went to school in Gainesville and now works at Disney's Animal Kingdom. And one thing I'll tell you is alligators are back. Man, we were on a river in Ocala National Forest. Good news is we saw manatees right there. But boy, did we see alligators. I mean, over 100 alligators in a 4-day canoe trip. I mean, it was lots.
Pythons, too.
We did not see any there, but they are in South Florida, I've seen, down in Key Largo. Yeah.
I asked Thane how COVID affected the animals at the zoo. As the world shut down, got much more quiet in March of 2020, now a year ago, you could feel the difference in the air. It was quiet, pollution was down. I wondered how the animals reacted.
We talked to every single keeper. Different ones might have different stories. I do know 2 groups of animals were observed being behaviorally changed. One was the elephants and the other was the gorillas. Some of that is that the way humans measure intelligence, elephants, great apes, and whales are the 3 smart groups. They have real big brains, they have social structure, they have language. So we sort of notice things with them more easily than we would say, gosh, how did the turtles change? I mean, it's hard to know what a turtle's doing. But yeah, the elephants are very used to people, as are the gorillas. Gorillas especially look at humans and can tell the hierarchy of a group. We have a female that now doesn't live here. We've sent her to another zoo, but her name was Mookie, and she was left-handed, and she would pull a giant dirt clod and throw it at the public. But she only threw it if she saw a group at the person that she could identify that's the alpha right there. That's the person in charge. And oh my gosh, over the years, she hit Marge Schott in the chest, and she hit the head of surgery from Harvard Medical School. You know, there's a group of doctors here, and bang, and hit him right in the head. And I said, oh my gosh, sorry. Are you in charge of this group? And they said, yeah, he's the guy. I mean, they can tell. They can tell. And so they wondered where everybody went. I know our giraffes were sad to see us go because they normally, during the day, just get a regular giraffe diet, which is perfectly healthy for them. But when we do feeding for the public, they all day long, people are feeding them lettuce and they get a lot of interaction, and that didn't happen for maybe 6 months. The humor of that is, and you saw this, I'm sure, with many of your patients, the keepers love their animals so much. It's sort of like they're their children. So to this day, I mean, if you go over to feed a giraffe, you got to have a mask and you got to wash your hands because keepers don't want anything, even though there's no cases with hoofed animals who've gotten the COVID virus. But the keepers are like, I don't care. Nobody's getting near my giraffe. We've been fortunate. We've not had a lot of COVID with the staff, and we've had none with our animals because a number of zoos did. San Diego Zoo, the gorillas got it, and the Bronx Zoo, the cats got it. At Louisville Zoo, some of the monkeys got it, but all of them survived, so that's good. Yeah, animals and their behavior, it's interesting.
They feed on the public sometimes, don't they?
They do, yeah, they do. They know what gets a response. The response will then reinforce it and they'll do it again. So that's the tricky part.
I used to enjoy the Monkey Island with the goats and the monkeys.
Yeah, exactly.
That was quite a spectacle at times.
It's been an interesting evolution because that island, if we went out there now, is completely different. When it was founded in 1932, it was the world's first barless outdoor monkey exhibit, just with a moat to keep them in. And people loved it. They loved it all the way till a couple of years ago. The problem was, you know, you could end up with challenges also for the monkeys. And so we changed it. Now half of it is bald eagle area for some rehab bald eagles. And the other is for Galapagos tortoises.
Well, what do you say we look at some animals?
Let's do it.
As we head outside, I notice Thane's mask is covered in bright images of caterpillars. He puts on a zoo cap and off we go. It's a weekday, but the zoo is fuller than I expected, considering we are still wrestling with the pandemic. Almost all of the visitors today are tiny children. It couldn't be a more beautiful day. In fact, after a string of snow and cloudy cool temperatures, this, come to think of it, is the first beautiful day Cincinnati has seen in weeks, maybe even months. The animals feel it too. As we approach the meerkats, one of my favorites, we see a young male meerkat lazying on his haunches, waving a paw in the air to the delighted kids, including me.
I really like the meerkats.
So meerkats are one of the most popular animals at the zoo, and it's because of their behavior. They are very attractive, and they'll do this behavior where they come out. In nature, if some are, you know, foraging, one will stay on a lookout to watch as they're watching for avian predators like hawks. And if these guys even here see a hawk, man, they're going to put out a warning cry, and they will all disappear down a hole right now. In nature, they'll dig in the ground and eat beetle grubs and insects and worms as they can find. They're a type of a mongoose, and they're tougher than they look. You know, you wouldn't want to grab one, even in the zoo or certainly in the wild. They bite the tar out of you. There's no doubt about that. Now, this barrier is new over the last year, and it's because of all the animals that have caught the COVID virus. Predators from these guys, meerkats, all the way to the big cats are the ones that are susceptible. So I've heard that cats are susceptible. I don't know if they've had trouble, if they die of it. I don't know of a zoo in America that's lost any animals.
I haven't heard of this.
I do know friends of mine that are up to speed on epidemiology are very concerned that animals do catch it from us. That whole sort of anthropogenesis thing is a way of continuing that the spiral of who knows where it's going.
It's a learning curve, isn't it?
It is a learning curve, and a lot of times it's, you know, one step forward, two steps back. But you just keep going. Zoos are very practical places, you know. We're open to the public, but it works out. Same thing, anything animals can do, they'll try it. To be honest, wild animals, if you caught a whole pack of wild dogs that are adults, they'd probably get out of there because they'd be so scared.
Yeah.
Ones that have been raised in captivity, fed every day, have a whole different perspective. Our giraffe yard is a neat example of how the zoo has evolved. Historically, our giraffe were squeezed into a pretty small area in our elephant building, where we had seven different species all living in that same area, but each had a very small yard. Now that area is just for elephants. In fact, we're going to build a real big one that's 5 acres just for elephants that'll open in 2024. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But we took this whole area and the big barn that's hidden in the hill there just for giraffes. And there's some tricky things. It doesn't really have fences around it. It has this moat, and giraffes do not like to walk down and then back up. They also aren't great at walking up a steep hill. So relatively minor barriers, but it'll keep a giraffe in. If we got rid of the giraffe and instead put a rhino in here, you have to change that completely around. Depending on the species, it also shows a lot of the tricks we use. You've got a huge set of bamboo on different sides just to sort of hide and screen out. We have to get more plants to kind of hide it so we feel like we're in a garden. But yeah, our giraffe herd is great. We've got 5 giraffe right now. 2 are young males. Eventually, they'll be shipped to other zoos for breeding reasons. Most animals are this way.
that you can't have too many males together if there are females present, because they're very competitive and they'll fight with each other. So if you look at our gorillas, in each group there's one dominant male. Same thing with elephants typically, and same thing with giraffes. So as those males grow up, they'll go somewhere else to breed. Now, ironically, you can have all the females you want. You can have 20 female giraffes. They're more cooperative, less trouble. That's how it is. Fortunately, they're real good breeders. They do like to be fed by the pup.
That's great.
Yeah. Gary, this is a neat example. And when we moved those cars, we were able to open this. This one yard has impala, crown crane, the national bird of Uganda, guinea fowl, the little ones at chicken size. These are all from East Africa. We've got Thompson's gazelles, which are the favorite food of cheetahs. They're the little teeny antelope over there. Yeah, that looks like a kudu. A lesser kudu is a really pretty animal with very big twisted antlers. Oh, yeah, there's a wildebeest sleeping upon the ground. The world's smallest wildebeest turtle, but his name is Mike.
I always love the okapis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're in another part of the zoo, but they're wonderful.
Yeah. Those African wild dogs.
Yeah. We've had a lot of luck with wild dogs. Right now, brought in a great big group from another zoo that typically they are like wolves, and there's only one alpha male, one alpha female, and it's the only one to breed. And the female will suppress the others from breeding by urinating.
Yeah.
But one of the males didn't get that message at another zoo, and he bred a non-alpha female anyway, so they ended up with two litters of 10 animals each. So they came here, and then as they grow up, send a few out to others. You know, there's a lot of care put in it, but there's going to need to be over time. Certainly importation one way or another of some wild gene. Mm-hmm. We haven't pulled it off, but there are researchers working with wild dogs to be able to go over and collect sperm and bring that back and do artificial insemination. But there's a lot of steps between here and there to make it work.
How domesticated do they get?
You know, that's interesting. They still are wild animals. Sometimes if there's a real loud noise, they just like that, very aggressive. If, for instance, in Yellowstone, when the wolves came back, they killed the coyotes. That's the way they are, they're territorial. This species is surprising because they are so lean and they're so attractive, they don't seem like they're very dangerous, but, you know, they're a feared predator, very efficient, just like wolves.
They hunt as a team, don't they?
We finally make our way to Fiona and her mom, Bibi. The covered enclosure echoes with kids' laughter and excitement over Fiona. Fiona herself eats up the attention. She moves so gracefully underwater. She runs in long strides, reminding me of a hippo ballerina. She never stays out of sight long and returns to louder squeals of joy each time she makes an entrance. It's gotten so loud to a roped-off area behind the hippo pavilion. It's not just Fiona that's drawing attention. Thane himself and the camera has attracted some attention hounds as well. Hippos like lettuce. Kids love cameras. Thane unlocks the gate and takes my camera person, Suzette, to a little ledge to film from. Within seconds, Mama Bibi investigates and gives the okay for Fee to make her appearance. We're not disappointed. Make sure to see the video that accompanies this podcast on Talking Pets YouTube channel. So, how do you call a hippo?
Well, the best way, here we go. There's the girl herself. The best way is with a big head of lettuce. Yeah. She's a food hound. And when we first put her out with mom, she was only 1 foot tall. And I was like, man, I hope that hippo's gonna be all right. And our curator said, she's a hippo. If she can't figure out how to live in the water, there's nothing we can do. And that's just what hippos do. She's got to have an alpha color. So sure enough, she puts herself to the top and come on in. Where'd you go? We'll see if they come back down here. They're hiding underwater somewhere.
What is their main diet?
Here. Well, they're herbivores, So they eat a lot of grain, things like horse grain, and a lot of hay. That's the principal part of their diet. They get a fair amount of greens and fruits, greens like cabbage and lettuce, and fruits for training. There's a lot of training that goes on behind the scenes, not for like shows, but for husbandry. To move them if you need to move them, or to get them to stand still if that needs to take blood. Over the years, we've gotten really good. We've got a lot of animals that just stand there, and you know, like a tiger, an elephant, And they'll stick them and take blood.
They do the offer.
Yeah. There she is. There's Fiona and her mom. So don't drop that camera no matter what. You might back up a little. She can really reach up. It's okay. Hi, baby. Hi, babe. I don't have anything, but where's your daughter? Where's your little girl? There's Fiona. Yeah, looking good. Hi, Fee.
They only live in the water.
Hi, Fee. Yeah, you came to see Suzette, didn't you? Yeah. Dr. Gary says, I think Fiona's great.
You are great.
How are you doing? Oh, you are so pretty. Look at those teeth. Let's see your teeth.
She's growing up. She's four years old last month.
Ah, happy birthday. Thank you for that show.
So people live near the water because they need the water both for transport, for food, for fishing, for clothes, cleaning. And the hippos all live in the water. And at night, they don't eat in the water. At night, they come out and eat on land. Okay. And so if you live near the water, you're going to have a farm and a garden and a house and a village. So that's where the conflict happens. The same thing happens a lot with elephants. Same exact thing, which is, you know, we don't live there, so we think, boy, isn't that great in India? They've got all these elephants. But if you're trying to have a rice farm and the elephants come through, if you don't chase them out there, they'll eat the whole thing.
Sure.
I mean, these guys eat about 100 pounds a day of food.
Wow.
Our elephants eat 250 pounds a day. So you do that in nature and somebody's garden is gone. So trying to figure out how to mitigate those conflicts.
That's like 5 or 6 bales of hay per elephant.
Yeah. They eat a lot. They poop a lot. Anyway, yeah, that was fun that she came
up.
That
was great.
Yeah, you got closer than you thought. She was raised, as you know, literally by hand.
Hill.
And so she's a people hippo. Normally hippos, hooked animals, couldn't give a hoot about people.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have nearly as big a brain as an elephant, but it's not fair in some ways to say one's smart and one's not, because organisms are as smart as they need to be. You know, there's insects that don't have much of a brain to think of, and they do the darndest thing you ever saw in your life. So organisms have a way of knowing how to get along, and hippos are certainly an example. They lead relatively simple lives. During the day, they'll live in a big group. A hippo group is often called a bloat. So a whole group, dozens, we can live together, literally laying around on each other, in the water, staying cool, coming out at night, going off to feed, sometimes walking 5 kilometers one way just to go get food, and they walk back. And so that pretty much makes up their life. They don't spend a lot of time fearful of predators, and they only live where there's water. Now, during dry season, they live in a part of Africa where there can be periodic droughts. They have challenges. You know, you've got to pay attention to the older ones and say, all right, look, there's not water here, but we know there's going to be water upstream, so we're going to just keep walking until we find it.
Still reeling in the awe of Fiona walking down the hill to the cheetahs. We have been blessed in Cincinnati to have had over 50 cheetahs born in captivity here at Mast Farm in Loveland and now Boyer Farms in Warren County. Thane introduces us to Andy, a cat ambassador who runs cheetahs out at the new Cheetah Run at Boyer Farm. And she tells us how dogs play an important role in raising single cheetahs that cannot be returned to the wild.
So here are your cheetahs, Suzette. These are the two old boys I told you about, Bravo and Champ.
Are they the oldest cheetahs in captivity?
They're the oldest we've ever had. And I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure where the other one is. But
still look good.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
They've done well. Yeah, I bet. The males are not as quick a runner as the females. That's our experience. It's very hard for people to measure that in the wild. Here, with our runs, the females are lighter. Most of our females weigh about 85 pounds. The males can get 120. Also, they hunt in a group. These are two brothers that are stuck together. So as a result, they're just lazier. Whereas females always hunt by themselves. And if they have young, they have to hunt every day successfully or the babies will starve.
Do the males try to kill them?
We have never had a problem with that. You know, cheetahs aren't like lions. They don't really live in big groups anyway. This guy's, I think, was glad to be out on a good day. Andy, how are you?
Good.
This is my friend, Dr. Gary Clemens.
Nice to meet you.
Gary's an old friend and a veterinarian. Andy is one of the people who leads our cat ambassador program.
We have our new running facility out at Boyer Farm where we can run our cheetahs. It's the biggest running field in the world. Like, there's no way there's anything bigger than that.
Yeah.
And it's super, super cool. So
that's amazing. What a great. What animals do you have domestic dogs cohabitating with?
Yeah, it's mostly the cheetahs. So all the cheetahs that we have in our ambassador program, they could not be raised by their mom for any number of reasons. It happens in Africa, and unfortunately those cheetahs don't survive. But when it happens in zoos, we can actually take those cheetahs, hand-raise them in our ambassador program. But we still want them to have that companionship that they would have had with, like, their siblings or their mom. And we don't really want them jumping and climbing and playing with us like they would with their siblings.
Sure.
It's cute when they're little. It's not cute when they're full grown. So the dog kind of serves as that, like, training tool for us to help teach them how to play and how to interact and get their energy out. But also it's just a companion for them. So we get a young puppy and then they grow up together. They kind of get to go through all of life stages together. And it's really, really great. We've had Remus is our 7th cheetah dog pair. that we've had successfully. And then after they do their job with their cheetahs, they usually stick around for about 2 to 3 years, and then they get adopted out to one of us.
Do the cheetahs inhibit their aggressive play with the dogs?
They kind of learn how to play with each other. So they kind of develop their own language and their own communication style with each. Like, each dog and cheetah pair plays differently as well. So we have our older cheetah dog pair, Donnie and Moose, are much more rough playing than the younger ones are, but that's just kind of their style. And they're also a lot bigger cats. Our Donnie is our biggest cheetah. He's 140 pounds, which is huge. He's the biggest one in maybe the world, definitely the United States. But Chris and Remus are a lot smaller. And they just have a different kind of communication style. They just kind of figure it out. It's something we don't understand as people, but they have fun with it, and it's cute to watch.
What age do you put them together?
As pretty much as young as we can get them. So we got Chris when she was like 3 days old, and we started looking for a puppy right away. But it still was a few months after that before we got the puppy in. And then during that time, the trainers are spending 24/7 with the cheetahs to kind of develop that bond and that relationship. So when they are full grown, we can share space with them and do our cheetah runs and all that fun stuff.
That's yeah. Amazing. That's great.
It's the dream for sure.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, great meeting you. All right. Yeah, so come on back.
We end our tour of the zoo at the gorilla enclosure. While still in his office, Thane had mentioned the catalyst of the death of Harambe was inspiring in part for the More Home to Roam capital campaign to give elephants and other large animals more space to thrive. The gorilla enclosure is now twice the size it was just those few years ago. Thane was excited to see that Nadume, a baby gorilla born here at the zoo, is now finally back in Cincinnati after being on loan to live with and mate with Coco, the gorilla that spoke American Sign Language. When Coco passed away, Nadume came home at the age of 33. The zoo created a third family group with Nadume. He has been introduced to a troop with two other female gorillas, Chewy and Maria.
After Harambe got shot, we dedicated to double our space for gorillas so we'd have more here, and double our commitment to protecting gorillas in the Congo, which we've done. Yeah, so it's a really, really good indoor space. On a day like today, you can see them. Although some might be out as well because it's so pretty, but you know, often we're open at night and we're open in the winter, so giving them more space was really valuable. In fact, we have a great big capital campaign we're doing right now called More Home to Roam, and the purpose is exactly as it implies. We want to, you know, quintuple the space for our elephants and double the space for our gorillas, etc. So we've sort of done that a step at a time.
So we have three family groups, three males, one male each. Not 100% sure who's out here right now. I see these two females. Here's one, another one laying down over there. We went to a great effort last year, you might remember, in 2019, bringing back Ndume, a male that was born here and he'd been living out west. But he's back. And this might be his group, I'm not sure. This was a visionary exhibit. It opened in 78, and it was the first open-air outdoor gorilla center with no enclosure to speak of. And everybody was nervous they'd climb out, but there used to be a...
Where's the new gorilla area?
Yeah, we're going to go right there now.
Okay. Where was he kept?
He went out to a place called the Gorilla Foundation. I was fortunate a few years ago to go to the Congo, where the zoo is involved with wildlife, you know, gorilla conservation, and to see wild lowly gorillas. And it's just like this. If the male's calm, everybody just lays around. They don't have a lot to do. There's plenty to eat. But if the male wants to move, they all move. And if there's stress, you know, he'll... threatened, but he is worried about other males. So we give them different things on different days for enrichment. This is, you know, we'll take a blanket, play with it, or put it over, or lay on it. We put different food and things like those boxes. There's also little food containers inside these trees where they can reach in and get peanuts and things like that.
How did the females accept him when he came?
Well, that reintroduction animal, particularly a male animal, to a group is challenging because the males are big and they're tough and fierce. And if they feel threatened, they hurt the females, they can bite them. So what we needed to do is put him with older females like this. These are grandmoms. They've been with lots of males. They're not threatened. They're old enough, they're not flirting with him. They're not competing over him. And they've kept him nice and calm. Yeah, so it's worked.
Look at that. He's posing.
So this is a neat space because it's so big. There's a lot of vertical space for them to climb, and they can create nests up in here at the end of the day.
They all look very calm.
Yeah, they're good animals. This was a new flooring idea for us that we borrowed from the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago. Instead of concrete, which, you know, nobody would want to walk on concrete the rest of their life. This is 6 feet of pine bark from Mount Shasta in California. It's permeable enough that urine goes through it. There's a drain system under it. will periodically use water to sort of moisten it. And obviously we can pick up the feces, but it's a much better substrate for them because sometimes they'll be up here and if they're real excited, they'll swing or they'll jump down. Concrete over time is harder than any. So we've gotten better at trying to put their natural substrates.
Yeah.
Historically, zoos, and over time, we've realized you can do it a different way. So they don't have to always be on hard surface. A great leap forward for us. And part of that program I mentioned, more home to roam, more outdoor space, more indoor space. There's an equal space this big in the back for the third group is, where they do training.
I'm sure you have people from zoos all over the world come to see what you've done.
They do. Zoo people love to visit other zoos. Zoo directors love to have other directors come, showing off and peer review. But zoos are more similar than different, so there's a lot of trying to borrow ideas from other zoos.
Thane shakes my hand and the masks go back on as we wander back into a crowd of people. There are too many stories I've yet to hear, but we have taken so much of his time already. It's been the best zoo day ever. How many of us can say they get to have a personal tour by the director himself and also have gotten hippo kisses from Fiona the hippo? Not many. So I thank you for coming along on my journey with me today. We are so lucky to have a zoo director like Thane Maynard. He's probably given this tour thousands of times, but one or 1,000, his passion for our zoo is no less. I encourage you to visit and support the zoo this spring after all the animals missed us as much as we miss them. Thank you so much for joining me today. You can get this and all my other podcasts hosted on Spotify Anchor.fm. Subscribe and follow me there. If you have questions or comments, you can call my Pet Talkers call-in line at 304-TALK-PET. That's 304-825-5738. We may even read your question on the air. So for now, I'm Dr. Gary Clemens. Please consider adopting your next pet from an animal shelter or rescue group. Spay and neuter your pets, and God willing, I'll be back soon with another episode of Talking Pets. For now, love on your pets with all the love they deserve, and have a blessed week.